Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 216 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Donny O'Rourke finds himself in the book-blessed town of Ullapool in May, celebrating the bonfires and bluebells of the Celtic Beltane Festival. Following Donny, Chris Arthur reflects on the inspirations of his odd object essays and considers the popularity of this particular form and the most important aspect of oddness within it. First, here's Donny O'Rourke with Beltane.
May. The very word begins a blessing, asks permission, seeks leave, contains grace. May is Mary's month, we were told at the Catholic schools I attended, and this time of year remains numinous and luminous, and not just for faithiests like me. After sunset, at April's end, bonfires were lit, libations poured, holy wells dipped into, and preparations made for the cattle to be driven to the summer pasture. The votive purveys, a primal vestige from the days when the people of Ireland and Scotland were nomadic herdsmen and women, that age of myths before communal settlement based on sowing and reaping. Their word Beltane may mean bright fire. My mother had a well-stocked storyteller's store of lore from her native Ulster, and Dad told his own tales of Red Clydeside. With the workers of the world uniting too, you can see how heady it all seemed. The bluebells, the hawthorns, the lilac, and the broom. Gorse has sharp thorns, broom does not. It's chrome. Soft plumed emergence told travellers it was the moment to take to the road with their wagons. As Adam McNaughton put it, when yellow's on the broom, when yellow's on the broom, when the gang about folk tack the road, and yellow's on the broom. Ullapool loved the broom so much, it called its lovely long fjord of a loch after it. Here in Britain's top left corner, land of shining shores and gulf-like mountains, primrose paths and gorse-glistered glens, May, the yellow month for gales, glows with an ingot gleam intensity in the lingering light. It's when Ullapool's book festival blooms and blossoms too. The ever-widening circuit of literary gatherings has nothing remotely like it, literally, though let's be careful with the notion of remote. Highlanders bristle at the term. Remote from where? Stavanger? The Faroes? Malmö? Oh, you mean London? Yes, it is beguilingly unique. A Canadian novelist of international renown will attend a reading by a young poet just beginning to make a local mark, who will take part in a workshop run by one of the world's foremost folklorists, who will contribute a cameo performance to a ceilidh comhairle at which every invited writer will be present. Participants eat together, support each other by going to all the programmed events, and generally bond beautifully. There is such a thing as an ego-free lunch. Democratic, friendly, open, inclusive and welcoming, a place of fair dues and good humour, warmth and wit. Scotland in microcosm, one hopes. Anyway, there has never been, to my knowledge, a single pompous, portentous or pretentious word spoken in public or private. Not even by me. And I was the festival's honorary president for three fortunate and fulfilling years. Run by inspired and inspiring women from the village, it is a compelling case in point of how to get from local to global without passing through parochial. Since the writers tend to be Scottish, have ties to or publish books about Scotland, the Ullapool ceilidh of ideas, the word simply means visit, a congenial dropping in, allows a think and a drink, a conversation about the nation in a pleasant place and special space, and in a month never miserly with the splendours of the season. For the Celts, summer started here. No, not in Ullapool specifically, but in May. Obdurate, deluded optimists, those gales, many a belletrist from warmer climes will have thought as a flurry of unseasonal sleet, hail or even snow descends upon the palm trees that strike a tropical note along the front, courtesy of the Gulf Stream. But we know what they meant. The midpoint between the vernal equinox and the summer solstice and the occasional breeze without a freeze. For me, May's grandest glory is its ambiguity and our ambivalence. Spring or summer, or both, or neither. A season of and unto itself may be all and none of this. Not winter, though. On that the flora and fauna can agree with me. A cuckoo is oh-yessing its ascent as the village unhurriedly stirs. Laid out on a commercially efficient but graceful grid, Ullapool was a planned village, constructed further to enrich a wealthy laird through the catching, landing, gutting, salting and selling of herring. When the shoals shrunk, times were as hard as a fishwife's fingertips. Much later, the Soviet factory ships would weigh anchor. Cold war, colder vodka. Bill Forsyth had touching fun with these close encounters in that couthy yet subversive masterpiece, Local Hero. The shop sell this and that and tourist tat, but mostly in a sassy, classy way. Everyone loves to be interrogated by the FBI. What'll it be? Asks the barman in the ferryboat inn. Seasonal produce can be found there and elsewhere. Ullapool is famous for fish and chips and seagulls. Go on. Think it through. Make the connection. Exactly. Just yesterday it happened again. A gull the size of a small helicopter snatched an entire fish supper, its carton opened that very minute from the grip of a phased and furious holidaymaker. His wife found his discomfiture hilarious, only ceasing to laugh when the very same bird nabbed her fish and chips. Saucy. Extra salt for the wound. To get a really good look at May in Wester Ross, install yourself by the picture window and balcony of the Cayley Place. A celebrated biographer, journalist or performance poet might be sitting beside you reading a bit, staring at the loch a bit, sipping tea a bit, nibbling a scone a bit. Emulate that writer and keep looking until you can see, truly see, not the present but the past, when this stretch of water was thick with boats waiting to take the population of this place and places like it to exile in Canada. Proud, hard-working, God-fearing clansmen and women, crofters loyal until almost the end to the chiefs who betrayed them, herded onto emigrant ships like the sheep that had displaced a culture and its customs, a way of life. That wilderness, landowners and their guests liked to hunt, shoot and fish on, was home to the ghosts beyond the glass, savouring the blackthorn and catkin. One last May, in their bygone day and age. Perhaps the book festival is so scrupulously quirky because the Cayley Place is a meticulously original one-off as well. The former grew out of the latter, basing itself in the hotel established in his former family home by the distinguished actor Robert Urquhart and his gifted wife Jean in the early 70s. Relaxed, bohemian, arty without being farty, no sense unstimulated. It was, with every tune played, each scene acted, all the delicious dishes served, a reproach and provocation to joyless Calvinism and the pervasive Presbyterian prudery then prevalent in these parts. There's really much fun in fundamentalism. Fun, frequently fruitful fun, productive pleasure was what Jean remained resolute in supplying. Influentially so. Modern Highland hospitality, twee-free, with a traditional twist, a style soon mimicked, quickly ubiquitous, was invented on the shores of Loch Broom. Her daughter is confidently in charge now, and the visionary impresaria has become an admired and abidingly thrown politician. Flaneurs, alertly idle, busily saunter, flitting from cafe to cafe in cities, but Ullapool will reward the wanderer in search of people to watch and passing scenes to survey. Before the village became a boomtown, so to speak, in the Cabar times before bus parties and bus passes, most travellers merely passed through en route to Lewis. I love to perch vacantly on a bench out by the headland, gazing at the Stornoway ferry coming in and out, glimpsing the Hebrides in muted, mist-smudged, watercoloured silhouette. Lewis is stony ground, a sandscape, a plain of peaty puddles, seldom lush or plush, with neither the trees to make its fables sylvan, nor the meadows that are a prerequisite for pastoral illusions. May has less to work with here, but can manage miracles in a hedgerow, work wonders with marram grass and bogwort. This far north, May is greeted with gratitude almost palpably, as nature seems to sigh with relief and exhilaration on this outlandishly austere Long Island, amid whose standing stones Beltane was ushered in with fire and feasting, the fairy folk never far away in the liminal gloaming, when the walls between worlds are thin and porous. Until fairly recently in the cyclical calendar of the circle besotted Celts, all household fires would be lit from the Beltane bonfire. My room in the Cayley place has a radiator, of course, a source of heat I will not need on this mild May evening. I shall honour nonetheless with a candle and a water glass bower of rowan sprig and pale purple lady's gown the first day of this auspicious month. Tomorrow I will give a reading in Edinburgh, a city May mellowed, refreshed, spruce and sparkling, not quite so grey as hair and chill are chased away. May was on the meadows and the bluebells still in bloom, while she was telling lovely lies in Sandy Bell's back room. In Gaelic, bluebells, whose dells of spells are beloved by the wee folk, were called cuckoo shoe and hated by pigs. It's the glycosides. A decade or so ago, various writers associated with the festival were commissioned to select 10 treasured titles, a little lending library to be made available in each bedroom. By chance, I have been allotted this ever-favoured smallish single with no bath, my room, and I recollect what this month meant to Camus in Algiers when he was young. I glance at the oblong Ullapool mirror above the bookshelf, reflecting many Mays of my own between early childhood and late middle age. By dawn there will be drops of moisture on the lawn. Since Beltane dew is said to promote beauty and youthfulness, I had better cross myself with a bead or two of that pagan holy water, break a bannock, and offer up a scapegrace doubter's prayer for all the blessing, boon, and bounty of the very merry month of May.
That was Donny O'Rourke. You can find out more about Donny on the RLF website. Next, here's Chris Arthur with Confessions of an Odd Object Essayist.
Adam Gopnik says there are three types of essay: review essays, memoir essays, and what he calls odd object essays. I'm particularly interested in this last mentioned type. It's fascinating how the unlikeliest objects can provide the impetus for a piece of writing. Before I started to explore this genre, I never realised how many things are poised to spring ambushes, luring the essayist into the astonishing mazes of meaning, memory and association that they contain. Essays help attune the ear to the music of things, but I'm still startled and delighted by the sheer unexpectedness of the connections that proliferate once I start to really listen to the notes that sound in the objects that catch my attention. The first essay I wrote over 20 years ago was sparked by thinking about the metal ferrule that capped the end of my father's walking stick. The essay I'm working on now examines a vulture's egg I found when I was 12. Looking through my 7 published collections and the 8 that's currently in press, I can pick out numerous other odd object essays to add to the ferrule and vulture's egg examples. Sometimes the identity of the object in question is evident from the title alone. 13 Ways of Looking at a Briefcase, Meditation on the Pelvis of an Unknown Animal, Sleepers, meaning railway sleepers, but often you need to go beyond the title in order to identify the originating object. In Miracles, for example, I'm concerned with a 32 million year old fossilised whalebone. The Walking Buddha Beckons focuses on a 19th century statuette from Thailand. Memory Sticks considers 4 old walking sticks. Of course, odd object essays aren't just about the objects they look at in a straightforwardly descriptive sense. It wouldn't do to see the essayist as the verbal equivalent of a slavishly literal still life painter, trying to lay down in words an accurate portrait of what appears before their eyes. There may be an element of plain representational writing, and the skill needed to do this well shouldn't be underestimated, but it's never the primary concern. As Adam Gopnik puts it, an essay of this type takes a small, specific object, a bit of material minutiae, and finds in it a path not just to a large point, but also to an entirely different subject. It's these unexpected, often meandering paths to destinations you couldn't have anticipated at the outset that holds my fascination and keeps drawing me back to this type of writing. The essay about the ferule turns into a meditation on language and how we acquire it. The essay on the vulture's egg starts as a memoir about my boyhood egg collecting, but soon moves far away from that to consider aspects of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, sky burial, archaeological finds on Orkney, and the history of touch. 13 ways of looking at a briefcase may begin and keep returning to a briefcase, but it's more concerned with aspects of sectarianism in Northern Ireland, the nature of leather, drumlins, the Book of Kells, and the artistic potential of sets of variations. At one point in that essay, I say, the briefcase, which on its own seems so limited, straightforward, uninteresting, in fact harbours unexpected doors that give access to other times, other places, that quickly lead from the ordinary into the extraordinary. Though I love finding these unexpected doors in odd objects and exploring what lies behind them, I wouldn't want to give the impression that all my essays fall into this category. Obelisk, for example, the longest essay I've published, may end up with an object, the obelisk of the title, which is part of a headstone at a remote cemetery in the hills above Belfast. But the essay explores the so-called Lisburn tragedy of 1898, which left a son shot dead and his father seriously injured under what remain mysterious circumstances. Far from looking at objects, what interests me here is the way different versions of history are manufactured, and how difficult it can be to reach through the stories individuals remember or invent to find out what really happened. Often, what I write about has nothing to do with objects, unless you could expand the usual definition of object so that it would include tracks left in snow, a cycle path, train sounds, remembered phrases, the sinking of the Lusitania, or encountering a terrorist in a second-hand bookshop. One of the odd object essays I most enjoyed writing was Substitute Psychometry in my first collection, Irish Nocturnes. Psychometry is the alleged ability, claimed by some mediums, to divine directly by touch the qualities, properties, and history of a thing. It's a faculty I've often wished I possessed. Imagine if an essayist was able just to pick something up, a discarded shoe, a child's doll, a rust-encrusted key, a hat, a sword, anything, and divine its story by touch alone. That would make essay writing easy. But writers have to work harder to open the unexpected doors and things. I had to employ the substitute psychometry of research in order to tell the story of the object that sparked this essay, a 200-year-old bronze Japanese temple bell that I found being used as a doorstop in a County Antrim junk shop. Using individuals' recollections, the inscriptions and symbols on this object's four faces, and some knowledge of Buddhism and Japanese history, I was able to reconstruct its story and add another chapter to it. In part, this essay is about the odd object constituted by the bell, its manufacture in 1807, how it hung in Rengiji Temple in Hiroshima Prefecture, its fate in World War II, namely confiscation for turning into armaments, how an Irish serviceman most likely took it from a military scrapyard and brought it home as a souvenir, its sale by a Belfast auction house, whose records were destroyed in the Troubles, the years it hung in a quiet garden in Hillsborough, and how, after a bereavement and house sale, it turned up in the junk shop. Finding all this out held something of the allure of a detective story, but the essay is as much about the contingencies of history as it is about this particular object, and about how we tune the elements of the earth into such different keys, from the haunting resonance of a temple bell to the detonation of an atomic bomb. What gave me particular pleasure about this essay was that in the course of writing it, I contacted Rengiji Temple and offered to return the bell. It was deeply satisfying to be able to play a part in sending it home, seeing it come full circle and being rehung at the temple in a special ceremony. I was especially touched by what an elderly member of the congregation told me. Whenever she gets sad, she says, she goes to the temple, rings the bell, and finds comfort in the story of its homecoming. the 19th century Scottish essayist Alexander Smith, whose collection Dreamthorpe deserves to be better known, once remarked that the world is everywhere whispering essays, and one need only be the world's amanuensis. This makes essay writing sound too much like taking down dictation, but I agree with Smith that there are openings into essays all around us. Virtually any object can be a starting point. Dog food, suburban lawns, the potato crisp, briefcases have all provided starting points for essays. Neil McGregor's History of the World in 100 Objects provides numerous examples of how all kinds of things can lead to the large points and entirely different subjects that Gopnik says characterise writing of this type. Reading McGregor's engaging history always reminds me of a comment made by Edmund de Waal in The Hare with Amber Eyes. You take an object from your pocket and put it down in front of you, and you start. You begin to tell a story. Though not always as obviously interesting as the Netsuk collection, passed down through several generations of de Waal's family, many objects nonetheless provide promising raw material for the weaving of essays. No wonder they're sometimes viewed as non-fiction short stories. Of course, essayistic writing doesn't need to be short. A focus on objects has led to some inspired book-length writing. The work of Henry Petrosky is particularly notable in this regard. As he puts it in The Pencil, A History of Design and Circumstance, to scrutinise the trivial can be to discover the monumental. That's a sentiment most essayists would agree with. Petrosky's work shows how the story of a single object told in depth can reveal more than a wide-ranging perspective. The Pencil offers a beautifully sustained example of the way Adam Gopnik says the odd object essay proceeds, using a piece of material minutiae as a springboard from which to dive into unexpected depths. Gopnik isn't alone in stressing the importance of objects in essay writing. In the summer 2017 issue of New Hibernia Review, James Silas Rogers says that ever since Montaigne, it has been a favourite strategy of essayists to take a simple object and use it as a point of departure for a much larger consideration. A lot of the pieces I've composed are examples of this strategy in action. I think it's quite correct to identify objects as an important feature of this genre. I'm happy to confess that many of my essays display the characteristics that Adam Gopnik, James Silas Rogers, and others identify. But when I think of the objects I've written about, ferules and temple bells, briefcases and whale bones, vultures' eggs and clocks, pelvises and pieces of linen, it's not so much the oddness of the objects that needs emphasised, more that the ordinary things around us, the constituent bits and pieces of the blizzard of flotsam that falls on any life, once examined, once essayed, will come to seem odd. Essays that stress the peculiarity, the mystery, the strangeness of the ordinary are surely much more interesting than those that just flag up what's weird. Estranging the familiar, reminding us that the everyday is utterly extraordinary, is more what my essays are about than offering a peep show into mere grotesquerie.
That was Chris Arthur. You can find out more about Chris on his website at www.chrisarthur.org. And that concludes episode 216, which was recorded and produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 217, in another instalment of Location and the Writer, we visit an historic library in the Scottish countryside and an equally historic Cambridge College. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.